But Psalm 121, or let's start with the music. Growing up, Finlandia, I thought, was the most powerful music I had ever heard in my life. And so I'm always thrilled by that hymn because of the power that I feel in when I listen to Finlandia. I can imagine the waves breaking on the cliffs around the fjords, and it's just very powerful to me. And in another note, Psalm 121, I happen to be old enough that Psalm 121 was a poem that I learned in the sixth grade out of our textbook. It wasn't church related, it was school. At the time that I was in elementary school, I can't believe I'm saying this, but at the time I was in elementary school, at least for a part of the time, we were able to pray every day. And so we did, in studying literary forms, Psalms were some of the things that we studied. And I think today by not including those in textbooks anymore, I think our poor children have lost something. Okay, so tonight we're going through Elihu's speech. And let me just say, I have always called him Elihu. I find Elihu a bit more dignified sounding, but unfortunately it doesn't come out of my mouth as easily as Elihu, so I apologize for that. So we've finally reached the area of Job where we can see some hope. We've listened to Job defend himself against the allegations of his friends and to lament over his plight for over 25 chapters. We've seen Job's theology vacillate between soundness and error. But now we are hearing from Elihu, who is rebuking all four men because of their lack of understanding of the sovereignty of God. Last week, Karen mentioned to me that she had found in one of the commentators that she's studying a suggestion that Elihu was perhaps the moderator that Job had been looking for and asking God for, or just saying out loud that he wished there was somebody to speak for him. But what we ask for sometimes is not always what we get, and because it's not good for us. God will only do what's good for us. So if we look at the word mediator, it's someone who works to settle a disagreement. So then I think if we look at that in a general sense, even if the commentators that we're reading don't mention it, we can look at Elihu as a mediator. Not the great mediator, of course, but a mediator. So, without written scripture, and we've got to remember that back in this time, they didn't have the Pentateuch yet. They really didn't have any written scripture. It was all word of mouth. So they had to depend on spoken word of God, either through knowledgeable believers or through visions and dreams that were given to them by the Lord. So Elihu may have been flawed in his view of the punishment of the wicked, but he did have a proper view of God's sovereignty. Because I think in Amy's section, he may be mentioned And in this one too, he mentions something about punishment of the wicked, which sounds like it's going to be more immediate than perhaps in reality it is. Today, we do seem to have a bit of a problem in the church with the sovereignty of God. Do y'all agree? Have you been to churches where perhaps it was God is going to give you, you know, if you just have enough faith that he's going to give you this mansion on a hill and unmeasurable wealth and things like that. Or if you tell him, I want this, he has to give it to you. That, I think, is one of the most offensive things I've ever heard. But
a lot of self-help type of thing. A lot of self-affirmation and you can do this, but not giving God the glory. Showing people that it's his power and his hand in guidance.
Right. So the important thing to remember is that Elihu does remember he does know that God is sovereign. He perhaps doesn't know how God works, but he does know that God is sovereign. I was curious and I looked up his name because, you know, if El is in a name, then it usually means something about God. So Elihu means my God is he. And then I looked up Bildad and Zophar. Bildad means old friendship, which possibly in his case had disappeared a long time ago. I don't know. He was not a very good friend. And Zophar means to chirp. So perhaps that explains some of the things he said. And of course we know that Job means persecuted or hated. We also can know that Job was from Uz. Bildad was a Buzite. And in Genesis we see that two of Abraham's nephews were Uz and Buz. So these towns were probably very close to each other, and they perhaps Elihu was the last one to come because maybe he had the shortest distance to go, but also for all we know they may have been distant relatives.
Okay. And so Elihu is the only Jewish name of the friends. I read that.
Oh, okay. Well, that's true. We don't think of that. Yeah. Good point. Okay. All right, so let's get into chapter 35. And because there's so much scripture, I'll probably be skipping over a bit. But in 35:1, it says, and Elihu answered and said, now, from what I've read it, he is answering Job's complaints from chapter 9:29 through 31, verses 29 through 31, and chapter 21:15. Would somebody like to read 9:29 through 31? It's chapter 9, verse 29 through 31.
Of Job, though, right?
Of Job, yes.
I can read that.
Okay.
I shall be condemned. Why then do I labor in vain? If I wash myself with snow and cleanse my hands with lye, yet you will plunge me into a pit, and my own clothes will abhor me.
So he's talking about, you know, what good does it do him to be good, or what good did it do him to be good? And so in 2-4 it says, "Do you think this to be just? Do you say, is it my right before God that you ask, what advantage have I? How am I better off than if I had sinned? I will answer you and your friends with you." So Elihu here is saying basically that it's inconsistent for Job to expect to be cleared by God and still say that God doesn't care whether we are seeking after righteousness. So he's basically saying, clear me, but I know that you really don't care about me. And that doesn't make any sense. So,
might as well leave him alone if he doesn't care about him.
Exactly.
Not clear him at all.
Exactly. And while Job lamented about God being silent or thinking that he was a really good man and that he didn't deserve any trials, Johnny Hartley says in his Job commentary that Elihu makes Job's complaint sound as scandalous as possible to make his own answers sound more reasonable. So, but you know, you can decide that. So Job and his friends have viewed God in a narrow way, like we were talking about the sovereignty of God. They've looked at him as basically works reward or evil deeds punishment, that if you're good you get rewarded, you're bad you get punished with trials and affliction. I know my nose is going to sneeze in a minute, but that's a very narrow view of the Lord. Anyway, so in verse 7, it says, "If you have sinned, what do you accomplish against him? And if your transgressions are multiplied, what do you do to him? If you are righteous, what do you give to him? Or what does he receive from your hand?" So in this, he's asking these rhetorical questions that are basically saying that your sinfulness or your righteousness really never is going to change God. His mm-hmm. character is set, and it doesn't change. I've heard it said that we can, I don't mess this up, you can't do anything on your own of your own merit to earn God's favor or to earn his election. But you can't do it if you are elect, you can't do anything to change that. You were his. Perseverance of the saints means that also he'll preserve us as well. Okay? Does that sound? Thank you. Okay.
Sounds like we're very lucky.
We are. Fortunate. Very fortunate. But we have to also realize that...
You notice I changed it to fortunate.
Yeah. But we have to realize that it's not for us to decide who's his and who's not. It's for him to decide. So one problem that I see here is that they, throughout the dialogue amongst the friends, was that they, at that time, they weren't aware that through Christ we can be saved, and that even the worst person can be saved, because and they can be saved at the end of life, because the thief on the cross was a very wicked man, and he realized that he deserved what he was getting, but he recognized God at the end of his life. He recognized Jesus as the Savior, and therefore was with him in paradise. So we have to use that as our hope for the world, that even the most wicked person could possibly be called by God to change. Okay. All right, so anyway, I'm sorry, I deviated from that a bit too. So in 9 through 12, Elihu also refers to when we're afflicted, but we call out to God wrongly. So, and he's not going to answer us then. If we're calling out to say, my electric bill is high, please send me some money. Have someone, please, Lord, have someone send me money. That's wrongly. He's not going to do that. Now, it might happen, but it's not going to happen because you're asking, because all you want is the money. We have to ask for his direction. What are you trying to teach me during this? So in 9 through 12, he says, because of the multitude of oppressions, people cry out. They call for help because of the arm of the mighty. So they're being, you know, crushed under something. But none says, where is God, my maker, who gives songs in the night, who teaches us more than the beasts of the earth and makes us wiser than the birds of the heavens? There they cry out, but he does not answer because of the pride of evil men. And not just because of our pride, too. So he's saying that Job cried for relief of his pain and his suffering, but he concentrated too much on himself in that. He didn't concentrate on learning about God through it. So he was concentrating on himself more than concentrating on God.
I wonder how you can, like, in the midst of it, it can be, you become a lot more narrow-sighted until the Lord's ready for you to learn that lesson. And I hope I'm not speaking out of turn by commenting, but just it's, when you're in the midst of that suffering, it's almost like you immediately get focused on how it is that you're feeling in that moment, and that's all you can think about. It's like, well, God, you want me to learn something, but I can't concentrate enough to actually learn it. It's how it feels, I think, a lot of the time. And it's interesting how it's like you don't learn that lesson until he's ready to, or ready for you to, until your heart is ready. But only he can know in that time.
And I think when we get to that point where we do go to the Lord with, what are you trying to teach me here? I think our hearts are getting ready for that. But you're right. When you're sick, when you have issues come up, and now, you know, every time you drive by a gas station, you're thinking, am I going to be able to fill the car up next time? So when issues happen like that, it is hard right at first. And perhaps the reason that Elihu may be saying these things to Job at this point is because Job hasn't he's come close many times to having the right view of God, but he just hasn't quite turned to God as he's forgotten that God loves him, I think. He's not looking at that love. He's looking more at why did you do this to me? Mm-hmm. So,
Oh, I'm just listening.
Oh, I thought you... No, please. Just jump in there, somebody. And I think today, even though Elihu is mentioning pride of evil men, I think our pride... Now, pride is really, really, really probably one of the hardest things to overcome. Mm-hmm. The hardest thing. Anyway, so I was, as a matter of fact, I was reading in this table talk and... He was defining. He was saying that pride can be, pride and humility can be vices or virtues. That when our pride is centered in us, then it's a vice. When it's centered in God, it's a virtue. When we're proud of the work of the Lord and proud of His redemption, then it's a virtue. But unfortunately, it's that vice that we deal with more than anything. You probably heard the phrase, "I'm so proud of my humility," but it kind of that sort of thing. And I think that Job was not humbling himself enough to speak to God properly. So in 13 through 16, he says, "Surely God does not hear an empty cry." In other words, he's not going to listen to you if you're not coming to him the right way. "Nor does the Almighty regard it. How much less when you say that you do not see him, that the case is before him and you are waiting for him. And now, because his anger does not punish and he does not take much note of transgression, Job opens his mouth in empty talk. He multiplies words without knowledge." So when he doesn't see God reacting, either making his plight worse or clearing it up, then he just babbles on about things that he really doesn't know about. Does that sound kind of like me? Okay, so that encompassed, there were four speeches for Elihu and Job, and Amy covered the first two. That was the third one. So the fourth one goes through chapters 36 and 37. And in this chapter, he starts speaking more on God's behalf. He's trying to say that he's representing God. He's in verses 3 and 4. He says, "I will get my knowledge from afar, and ascribe righteousness to my Maker. For truly my words are not false. One who is perfect in knowledge is with you." And he's saying that his knowledge is perfect, but he gets it from afar. So God has given him the word. So he's telling them that he's received his knowledge from God. Does that sound? Okay. So, and today, with the scriptures, we have all that knowledge there in front of us that men are supposed to know. There's some things we're not supposed to know. But that knowledge that we're supposed to know is right there in front of us. In verses 5 and 6, it says, "Behold, God is mighty and does not despise any. He is mighty in strength of understanding. He does not keep the wicked alive, but gives the afflicted their right." In this, he's talking about God's justice, how he rewards the righteous and punishes the sinner, which is basically the opposite of what Job has been accusing him of. "You're my enemy. I was righteous, but you've punished me." So Eliphaz is setting him straight. Elihu is setting him straight on this. And then in 10 through 11, he says, "He opens their ears to instruction and commands that they return from iniquity. If they listen and serve him, they complete their days in prosperity and their years in pleasantness." So we know that God deals with sinners by getting their attention in affliction, but we also know that we're all sinners. There's not, the good over here and the bad over here. We're kind of blended because we all sin and fall short of the righteousness of God. Amy, I don't remember, but I thought you mentioned this C.S. Lewis quote that pain insists upon being attended to. God whispers to us in our pleasures, speaks to in our conscience, but shouts in our pain. It is his megaphone to rouse a deaf world. So when...
I didn't mention it. That's great. Shouts to us.
Yes. So when, is it in John that he, in his epistles, where he talks about, being joyous about our trials because whom he loves, he chastens to correct us. So, and Job should have been that way. So, in 15, he says, he delivers the afflicted by their affliction and opens their ear by adversity. So that fits in with Lewis's quote. And Steve Lawson says that Job needed to meditate on God's goodness instead of his wrath. So we can especially see that in some of the next verses. 17 through 20. He's talking about the judgment and justice of the wicked and wrath. But 17 says, "But you are full of the judgment on the wicked. Judgment and justice seize you. Beware lest wrath entice you into scoffing, and let not the greatness of the ransom turn you aside." Remember, he's still talking to Job. "Will your cry for help avail to help you from distress, or all the force of your strength? Do not long for the night when peoples vanish in their place. Take care, do not turn to iniquity, for this you have chosen rather than affliction." So basically what he's saying is, he's warning Job that he needs to view his affliction correctly. That that God basically brings us back to him through trials and afflictions. And he's saying in verse 21 that, you know, you're turning to iniquity, you're turning to sin, because his sin was not in the beginning, but he was flirting with it very closely with the things he was saying to God. He was being very disrespectful. We should remember that God is very patient, is infinitely patient with us. As with Jonah, remember we heard about that. He afflicted him, and when Jonah repented, God resurrected him. Job needs to be patient and learn while he is waiting for God to deliver him. And this is a great lesson for all of us, but I know patience isn't my strongest virtue. So, y'all.
It's a very rare person that has patience as a strong virtue.
I've mastered it.
You've mastered it. Okay. It's wonderful.
We're getting patience right now. That's what my mother used to say. She said, that's what you're... Because it would be that anticipation, you know, heartily. Mm-hmm. That reminded me of my mom.
You know, it seems like when I need patience the most is when I have it the least. Mm-hmm. I can be patient through a lot of things if in my mind somehow they're not that important, I suppose. But some of the strangest things send me off the deep end. And it's not a pretty picture, let me tell you.
Well, I mean, it does make me wonder, and I know some of personal stuff is kind of pouring over, that this is all hitting very close to home right now, but I'm going to try to keep it short. But I wonder, you know, when it feels like you're going to break before you're ready for God to let you learn the lesson, how do you keep moving forward? You know, that's just what keeps rolling around in my brain right now.
I know. That's the, and I could say, you know, be in the Word more, but if you're reading, you need to be reading what will help you through that. And, I know, I always know that the Lord will give me the strength I need for that, for the worst trials. I know that intellectually, but when the trial comes, you know, I go flying around the room saying, ooh. Sorry.
It's okay.
Lost my train, but but yeah, I know in my heart that he will give me the strength to go through it. We, being retired, we have watched much about Ukraine. Much. We're either on BBC America, or we're on Fox, or we're on something looking for what's going on. And all I can say is that it's a wonderful show of God's strengthening for when you see these people putting up with some of the things that they're they're dealing with. And when you think back that, you know, nearly 80 years ago, the very same thing happened. And the very, their grandparents or great-grandparents went through exactly the same thing. And they made it. And I hope that their faith was stronger afterwards. I hope. But when you see terrible things like that happen in the world and you see people strong through it, you know that that's not the normal human response. And so perhaps that can help some today.
Can also ask God for wisdom. He gives it to us generously, right? Mm-hmm. And that in that trial, ask Him, "What are You showing me?" Can kind of maybe put us in a different direction, or point us to those different scriptures, right. Maybe. And what?
Yeah.
How can I give You glory in this? Maybe that. Being honest with Him, right, and just asking Him for that wisdom, because I think sometimes we get so blinded, or at least I do, by my situation, that I don't want to, you know, see what He's maybe trying to tell me, because the pain can be difficult, and it's rough, and I have a close friend who has just been struggling with her husband, but she shines, they both shine the light of Jesus in that, and it's only because they're seeking after Him. They're open to His will and His way. It's not the way they want it to be, but it's the way that they're walking through and always praying for His deliverance, be it here on earth or in heaven. But that's, they're giving God the glory, and I think that's an encouragement for me for sure, to how can I give Him the glory in my suffering? Ask Him anyway.
Well, thank you.
It's a hard place to get to when you keep the why instead of what. What's my next step? What are You showing me? What am I supposed to do? It was interesting. Listening to a sermon on the way, and someone was talking about a Paralympic gold medal winner, and how he came to that point. And he said, "I was in rehab, and I looked around, and I saw people who were crumbling because they kept asking why." Mm-hmm. He said, "When I saw that, I started asking, what do You want me to do?" And anyway, and I won't go into that whole thing, but it was phenomenal. That what a perfect thing to listen to on the way to a study of Job.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Because he was going to sign on, you know, NFL football, and he had his whole career laid out, and he intervened to save 2 men in a fight, and he was shot in the back. And paralyzed, and he kept saying, why did You do this when I was trying to help other people? So when I got past the why and got to the what am I supposed to do, what am I learning, it just turned his life around. So anyway, just piggybacking off that.
So after this somewhat of an indictment towards Jonah and his, Jonah, Job, his J name, that after these indictments towards Job, and just pointing out to him directly, you're moving on the iniquity side. He starts talking to Job about considering God's greatness. So he starts out in 36:22-23. He says, "Behold, God is exalted in His power. Who is a teacher like Him? Who has prescribed for Him His way? Or who can say, 'You have done wrong'?" We can't say that to God. God never does anything wrong. So he's exhorting Job to consider how great God is, God's greatness. And where Job was saying things like, you've become my enemy, and you're coming after me, and you're harassing me all the time. Those were all wrong, because he's basically saying, God, you're wrong. Well, no, he's not. Okay, in 24, he says, remember to extol his work, of which men have sung. So then he goes into some information about God's creation, and he starts talking about the clouds and the rain, and when he says in 30, behold, he scatters his lightning about him and covers the roots of the sea, basically with the rain. For by these he judges peoples, he gives food in abundance. So while the rain produces the moisture that plants need to grow and provide, especially the plants for food, need to grow, he also can use these to judge people. And if you think about the flood and Noah, that's exactly what he did. And of course, that happened before this, so they would have known that as well. And so he's saying basically that was, the flood was the judgment on the people, and yet he uses that same rain to bless us with the water we drink, with the food that we eat. But also I think he's starting to maybe get us a little prepared for God speaking out of the storm. Mm-hmm. So then we go into chapter 37, when he's been talking about the storms. It says, at this also, my heart trembles and leaps out of its place. Keep listening to the thunder of his voice and the rumbling that comes from his mouth. So he's preparing for God to speak, only I'm sure that Elihu had no idea that God would speak after this. But the words he's been given are providing that. And he trembles at the sound of the thunder, Elihu does, and the flash of lightning, as you know, many of us do, depending on how close it is. I mean, mm-hmm. Just jump right out of my skin. but he reminds us that through these we can hear God speak if we just listen. He is saying, I am your God. But he does great things that we can't comprehend. We don't know how the lightning. We can analyze it and know, you know, sparks and things, but why does it hit here and not there? Why did that charge in the earth go, you know, and the clouds come to this spot and not to this spot? We can't ever know that. So in verse 4, he says, after it, his voice roars. He thunders with his majestic voice, and he does not restrain the lightnings when his voice is heard. God thunders wondrously with his voice. He does great things that we cannot comprehend. For to the snow, he says, fall on the earth. Likewise, to the downpour, his mighty downpour. He seals up the hand of every man, that all men whom he made may know it. So he's saying God controls our destinies, unlike some of the Eastern religions that are, you know, fate is just what happens. God is in control. Unfortunately, he's in control there too. Then the beasts go into their lairs and remain in their dens. He loads the thick cloud with moisture. The clouds scatter his lightning. They turn around and around by his guidance to accomplish all that he commands them on the face of the habitable world, whether for correction or for his land or for love, he causes it to happen. So he's basically saying that in the storms of life, let's say, that God can use it for correction, or it, literally rain, he can use to correct us somehow, to correct some issues, or he can, and the same with trials, correction, direction, leading us like he did Abraham to a different way, and he can do it for love, like they're saying the rain feeds the earth and feeds us. Those are, we're his creation. The earth is his creation. But it's just not for us to know totally, but we can learn from our trials. And it's a miracle to me that we do, because we are human and we are all I can think of is faulty, but we're not perfect, right? And so we learn from our trials, but we still may never know this side of eternity. Why? Because we are faulty. What a great word. I'm sorry. I don't know where I got that from. But he goes on through this, talking about the majesty of God in the clouds, in the rain, in the storm, that he gets our attention through that. And in verses 14 through 24, in verse 14, he says, "Hear this, O Job. Stop and consider the wondrous works of God." He's saying you've got to start responding to God in the right way. And so in the end, in 23 through 24, he says, "The Almighty, we cannot find him. He is great in power, justice, and abundant righteousness. He will not violate. Therefore, men fear him. He does not regard any who are wise in their own conceit." So we see here that he's finished up by saying, you know, stop thinking of yourself and start thinking about God, and he will deliver you. And some years ago, we knew someone whose husband was ill for some time with a terminal illness. And they had both grown up in the Catholic-type church, one in an Orthodox church, one in a Catholic church. And they had been taught works salvation, basically. So while he was sick, he wanted her to read Job to him. And through reading Job and getting to the, you know, how powerless we are in the face of God, they both came to true faith. He shortly before he died, and she continues in true faith today. So I think in my first lesson I was saying something about, you know, why is Job there? There are a lot of people who wonder why this book is there. And in the study, it's crystal clear to me now. It's there because it's one of the first books that teaches us of God's sovereignty in relation to our humanity. So, please give me your thoughts.
I'd often wondered, like, well, if this is my focus when we first started reading about Job, before we got deeper and deeper into it, and I looked at the pencil, wordy and poetic, and I'm not going to get it, so I'll just skip it. So this has been great, but there's the focus on why did God allow Satan to get involved. You know, you get hung up on that, and then you're like, ugh, and you just push it aside. But what you just said about how when people are reading it, and then they can empathize with Job, and they can understand, but then they start thinking, well, wait a minute. I mean, and then they see God's goodness and greatness. It is, it's healing rather than daunting, but this has been really good, because that was the one book am I horrible? That I just didn't want to read it. Just like I've never read Revelation by myself. I'm working on that. I'm doing Daniel Revelation. I'm doing the parallel.
It is a downer.
It really overwhelms me, I just run. I'm Jonah. Definitely. About that, anyway. Well, I am. Thank you for sharing that about the couple. And that's someone you personally knew, correct?
Yes.
Yeah, that's wonderful.
And I've centered more on the speeches of the friends, and they can be pretty depressing. Mm-hmm. But when we were going through that section, we could see that they did all the wrong things. But I remember, don't ask me where, but I remember Job said in one of his speeches to God that I know that you have closed their hearts to me. The only thing is, Job probably said it in an accusatory way rather than, okay, I have confidence in you, you've done this, and it's for my good. And that's how we should look at it. When we run into friends who don't, who not only don't say the right thing, they say all the wrong things to us, then we need to think, okay, remember, God is in control of everything. I mean, through the power of his will, he holds the universe together. So when you drop a paperclip on the floor, it did not escape God's attention. But if we trust him, there's something we can learn from that. And maybe one thing we can learn is, well, when I get back on my feet, I need to concentrate on praying for this person who has said these inappropriate things to me when I was hurting, and ask God to touch their heart and make them wiser than they were. So I can I think I was like you. I just kind of skimmed over Job because it was depressing. You go through a lot of verses of depression before you get to hope. And
I didn't understand how to read it. I know that sounds kind of dumb, but I just didn't know. Okay, because I was like, how do I read this? And then all of the breakdown and how we've really digested each piece, it's been like a, almost like another type of education within the Bible. Every book is, but, and we've done many together, but this one in particular, because it was the most difficult, I feel, in that way, it's the most rewarding, because I didn't expect it to just focus on the glory of God. And I love the poetry of how they, you know, they talk about when it's time for the deers to fall up. Is that what they call them? Fall. Just all that. It's just so beautiful. And you're seeing the creation all over. And you're seeing the beauty in what he does. But that's not the pearl I expected to see in Job.
Interesting, because it's almost like the way it was written is a foreshadowing of what the whole lesson of Job is about. If it's all suffering and trial and depression and anger and hurt and confusion all of a sudden leading up to when God presents himself at his time, you find relief. But only at that time, you know.
That's a good point.
And sometimes we're not relieved of the affliction, especially if it's a health thing.
Right, but the relief of knowing he is still there.
Right.
You know?
It's the spiritual relief that we should look for. And one thing that's been troubling me lately is he lost his children. He lost all his possessions. The only people he still had working for him were the ones that survived to come back and tell him the horrible devastation that he had received otherwise. But through that, he was faithful to God. But then when he started feeling bad, when it started touching his body, he changed, and that concerned me a lot, because I would think losing your children like that would be the worst. But to Job, him feeling bad and looking funny was the worst, and maybe the thing to learn there is that, you know, even when we think we don't have it, maybe we all have a certain amount of self-love that is beyond what it should be. I don't know.
But I do see how, I mean, when people are trying to go on with their life and recover, and then when that's taken away, then he felt like there's no hope, because now I can't even pull myself together to continue my life. That's kind of the way I took it. I didn't think about it that way, but that's an interesting.
Well, and the people around him, his family, his brothers and sisters, deserted him. He looked unpleasant, and people were ridiculing him. So how much of his lament and agony was connected to, well, now I don't even have my position, you know. I don't have what's important to me. So did he have, he may have been the most more righteous than any other man, is because God said it. But
well, do you think maybe it had more to do with his mind and his resolve weakening when his strength was gone? meaning he may have had the strength to still trust that the Lord knew what he was doing when his children passed and when his possessions went away. But when it finally sapped his physical strength, there was nothing left but for him to throw himself at God's feet.
That's
like kind of what I, maybe.
I hope so. That'll help me.
I haven't thought about that before.
That will help me because I just sometimes think I was just thinking of him in it might be a more negative way than I should have.
We love you, Amy.
So, bye bye.
Thank you, Rebecca. Sorry, I got her go.
That's all right. So, it's like, but then I also always think of, because one of the guys I was reading said, well, you remember too when you're thinking, when his wife says, curse God and die, well, you know, what a witch. He said, you've got to remember, she lost all her children. And at that time in the world, children were the only wealth that a woman really had. And she had lost everything just like he did. And now she had to take care of him while he was at the garbage dump. So, anyway, well, thank you for your input. I appreciate that.